Hello, this is News Director Larissa Donovan, and joining me on the phone is incumbent Beltrami County Commissioner Reed Olson. How's it going today, Reed?
It's wonderful. Good to be here. Nice sunny, humid day.
Yes, and I'm sure that'll stick around for a while.
Yeah, more to come.
So, Reed, I know you're the representative for Beltrami County District 2. Why don't you tell us a little bit about where District 2 is?
Okay. So District 2 is, I think it's probably considered the most urban district in Beltrami County. It's three city wards, wards 1, 2, and 4, and then Echoes Township. So it's basically the western half and the southern and western half of Bemidji, and then Echoes Township out by the airport.
So, and I know you, this past term was your first term as the Beltrami County Commissioner, but what did you do before you were a Beltrami County Commissioner?
Yeah, I served 4 years on the Bemidji City Council. Before that, I was a few years on the planning, the Greater Bemidji Area Joint Planning Commission. And I own a small business, the Wild Hair Bistro, downtown Bemidji, and I also am the executive director of the Nameless Coalition for the Homeless, which operates the Wolf Shelter downtown, an emergency overnight homeless shelter that operates from September through May.
All right. Are there any other roles in the community that you have served in the past?
Probably. I can't think right now, but yeah. I started getting pretty active in the community around 2010. I first moved to Beltrami County in 1994, and I worked and played out at the Concordia Language Villages, and was out there and in the area until about 99, and then I left for a few years and came back in 2004, and I've been a permanent resident of the county since 2004.
Well, what inspired you to run for a second term?
Well, I guess the short answer is that I really enjoy it. It's a big job. I've learned more as a county commissioner about things that I didn't really even, well, that I really didn't appreciate in heading into the job. I didn't know how important judicial ditches were to the state of Minnesota. And now I really do understand their importance and how they can be sometimes contentious. I think it's such a big job being on the county board. You're asked to make decisions and really get yourself informed on so many different issues. It's almost like going to school, and it takes a few years to kind of find your sea legs. So now, after 4 years, I feel really confident that I better understand the mechanisms of county government and how it relates to city government, but more importantly, state government, and that relationship between the state and the county that's just so crucial. So I feel like I am primed to do really well in another term.
All right. So my next question is on the last minute additions to the board's agenda. There has been some controversy over that. Most recently, a refugee resettlement action and a resolution requesting the governor to allow businesses in rural counties to reopen amid the COVID pandemic. Do you think commissioners should be able to continue to add agenda items in this manner?
Well, it's whether we should or not, I guess, is a separate issue. I'll answer that. But first, I just want to say it is absolutely within the rules or whatever to bring an item up at the beginning of a meeting. Anyone can add an item to the agenda. It's subject to a vote by the rest of the board. So that is the standard. That is the law or the rule anyways. I think that looking at the last 6 months and seeing these divisive issues pop up on our agenda without a work session behind it, I don't think it's a good idea. So I think moving forward, if any of us are bringing up a hot button item, especially when it's for a rhetorical vote, when it's a resolution that's just to say this is how we feel, I don't think we should be bringing those up at the last minute. I think that we should be talking about those through our work sessions. But then it's incumbent upon us as board members to vote down when someone wants to add something. I wouldn't say that we should pass a resolution saying that nobody can bring something to the board at the last minute, because, you know, like, look at where we are right now, where we had our last meeting 2 weeks ago, and our next meeting isn't until next Tuesday. We have a special meeting tomorrow for one singular item. But so in that 3 weeks, things can change, and maybe something would pop up that really needs action. And so we need to have that flexibility to be able to add things onto the agenda at the last minute. But it really needs to be things that are really about county governance. Maybe there's a grant that we need to hurry up and take advantage of, or a new rule comes to us from the state that we have to react to, or something like that, you know. But when we're looking at these more like identity politics sort of issues that are really just resolutions and statements of positions, I guess, we don't need to be bringing those up, I don't think, at the last minute.
All right. My next question is one that comes up a lot in county finances, at least. About 3/4 of the land within the county is public land, which creates a burden on the remaining 25% of taxable properties to operate the county. What are your thoughts on expanding the tax base?
I think that that's a loaded question to say that that puts a burden on the rest of the taxpayers. When you look at the land that is in, most of it is held either by the federal government, the state government, or the county. So you're looking at a lot of forest land. You're also looking at some parcels that have gone into tax foreclosure that we've taken back. We're always, every fall, we are selling back land that has, that we've received through forfeiture. And the other thing, you know, when you're looking at that, at a lot of the land that we have, we make money off of it. You know, we manage it. We sell stumpage rights. So people come in and log the wood, and we maintain, you know, we manage the forests. So to look at those forests that, sure, they're not on the tax rolls, but to look at them and say that they're a drag on the county is just, I think it's an incorrect perspective. Those parcels are making us money. You know, they are bringing down, you know, we make somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million a year net, you know, on logging rights. So the other side to that is, do we want to sell off and develop all of the woods that we have in our county? A big income source for our county is tourism and logging. So if we have good, well-managed logging practices, bringing money in, we have beautiful woods, which help keep our lakes healthy, and our lakes are so important for tourism. So having that land held in public trust is benefiting us in a lot of ways, you know. So I don't really buy that argument. Yes, 75% of the land are non-taxable parcels. A lot of that is because nobody could figure out a way to create a business model that would make those parcels sustainable, and that's why they keep on falling back into our hands, you know. And that gives us an opportunity to be good stewards of our land, still make some profit off of it, and help balance out our books. But you know, the bulk of the high value in our community are the lake homes and businesses, and they're not going to be in a stand of trees, you know, up near Fortown, up you know, northwest of Kellyer. So I think it's okay that we have a lot of land that is in public trust.
Well, thanks for that perspective. Another financial question I have include unfunded mandates from the state, which I'm sure you know, services counties must provide its citizens, but no funding from the state to provide those services or programs are necessarily attached. Is there anything you think the county can do about unfunded mandates?
Well, I really kind of take issue with the premise. Tell me if you could, I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, River, but What is an example of an unfunded mandate? What is something that we have to do that we're not getting paid for? Local governments provide services all of the time.
Particularly what comes to mind is the funding model for out-of-home placements. Other states across the country are mostly funded from the state and the feds.
Yep.
In this count, in Minnesota, it's a lot of local burden.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. And that is very true. And we have some of the highest out-of-home placement rates, I believe, in the nation, but surely in the state. And it is unfortunate that Minnesota is this outlier. I think I believe it's Ohio and Colorado. I think those are the two other states, and Minnesota, where the bulk of the cost of out-of-home placement are placed on the county. And so what do we do about that? You know, what I've been doing is I spent most of the 2019 legislative session in St. Paul lobbying to get the state to see that we're in a unique situation in Beltrami County when it comes to out-of-home placements. Some years ago, they passed, was it the year or two before that, they passed the state legislature passed a funding bill where it's $5 million that would go across the state to people, to counties, to help them offset the costs of ICWA cases, the Indian Childhood Welfare Act cases. And it was paid out proportional to your, based on your caseload. Beltrami County received, I think it was over $1 million from that five. So that's to say that our small county of 45,000 people has over 20% of all of the out-of-home placement, all the ICWA out-of-home placement statewide. So we are in a very, unique position here where we are way overrepresented. And so we have continued to work with the legislature. We got special funding passed some time ago that gave us, I believe, an additional $3 million a year for 10 years. Additionally, there's that $5 million that was split, and we got, I think, $1 million of that. And then last year, at the end of the 2019 session, we did get an additional $3 million. So we can sit and complain about unfunded mandates, or we can do something about it. And that's one thing that I have shown is my not only willingness, but also my ability to lobby our representatives and, in fact, other representatives to get them to urge them to support us and to make sure that we can remain solvent. I'm also very active in the Association of Minnesota Counties. In 2019, the AMC really went to bat for us, and we had huge, as I talked with my colleagues in the General Governance Committee, which is a subgroup of the AMC, talked to them about how this was a real existential threat, the cost of out-of-home placement to the county. And even though this was one county out of 87, we got the full support of the AMC, and they really pushed it for us. They carried a lot of water for us. So as the administrator and the social services director goes down to St. Paul, as I go down and Tim and others, then we find partnerships in the legislature, and then we find that funding. Another thing that we've been doing to help reduce the cost, and hopefully, I mean, the best way to reduce the cost of out-of-home placement is to reduce out-of-home placement. One thing that we're doing is working with Red Lake to help them become what's called an initiative tribe, where they would take over the bureaucratic and financial responsibility of all the out-of-home placement that occurs on the reservation. And I think that this will give them an opportunity to have more culturally appropriate programming, to be able to do more family stabilization, keep people in their homes, keep kids and their families together, and help make the families more successful. Because at the end of the day, that's the cheapest thing that we can do. That's the best goal we can have, is to have families stable, healthy, and intact. So that's what I am doing. I'm not just going to sit and complain about the hand that we're being dealt. I am always actively trying to find resources, to find creative ways that we can reduce costs and improve services.
All right. Well, my last prepared question is on the Beltrami County Jail. It's come under considerable public scrutiny and has received some serious fix-it orders from the Department of Corrections, among many other issues. What are your thoughts on the possibility of the new jail?
Well, I think that we have a great opportunity here. We have a jail that is definitely deficient. I don't think that anyone that has ever stayed there or worked there or has anything to do with the jail would disagree with that. The DOC certainly doesn't. The sheriff doesn't disagree with that. You know, the county board, I think, is all pretty much understanding. I think we have here an opportunity to have a really broad-based community-wide discussion about what we want to see in a county jail. my hope is that we build a jail with smaller, with fewer cells, and that we work on trying to find alternatives to incarceration. I mean, you look at the jail right now, you look at the roster. If you go online right now and look at the roster, I guarantee 90% are Native, even though they only make up about 20 or 25% of the population. So we need to figure out, why are Native Americans so overrepresented in our jail, you know? And another thing you can look at when you look at that roster is how many people in there are pre-trial or pre-sentence on misdemeanor charges. Why are we keeping people in jail for 2 or 3 months pre-trial on a misdemeanor, you know? Oftentimes it's because they can't afford to bail out. So if I get arrested on a given charge, I'm going to be able to bail out because I have, maybe I have money in my savings account, or I have family that'll help me out, or I can use my, put a lien against my house and bail out. Someone else with less means and the same charge will not be able to bail out. And then when we both get found guilty of the same charge, we'll both get sentenced time served. You know, so I'll get my one night that I sat before I went in front of a judge and posted bail. They'll sit 30 days or 45 days. And we'll both, in theory, have the same penalty of time served, and then the rest stayed. The rest of them, usually like 90 days on a misdemeanor. So, and that's not something that the county can necessarily do on its own, although the district attorney has a role to play in that. The arresting officers, I suppose, might, but really it's the judicial system. And how can we figure out ways to keep people out of jail that don't need to be there? You know, and here I'm talking about low level, nonviolent, you know, and we've got a ton of people in jail right now that fit both of those criteria, low level offenses, nonviolent, you know. So how can we keep those people out? We'll save money. They'll keep their jobs. They'll keep their housing. They'll keep their families. You know, there's situations where you can put someone in jail for 30 days. And then when they get to trial, they're found not guilty. But while they're in jail, because they're a single parent, they lost their kids to social services. They lost their job because they couldn't show up. And then they lost their housing because their housing was maybe subsidized by BICAP, or maybe they just lost their job and they couldn't pay rent anymore. So they went from being stable with their kids and employed to unemployed, homeless, and without their kids. So we're putting a tremendous burden on people that are already living on the margins. So again, with this jail, I'm maybe getting a little off topic, but I think with this jail, we have a real opportunity to look at, what does community policing mean? What is public safety really mean to us in a community like ours? And how can we build a jail that will help people basically never come back? You know, give, when they are there, help give people the tools that they need. And I know we have support in law enforcement to do this. I know we have support in city staff or county staff. So this is a great opportunity. And anybody listening to this, if you want to get involved in that process, call the county administrator and see if you can get on one of the many boards that will be coming up. One of the unfortunate things about the COVID situation is that it's postponed our ability to meet and start working on this. And I think we lost a year. I think it's going to take an additional year before the new jail gets built. And the jail that we have is so deficient that time is really of the essence to get together, figure out what we need, and create a new jail that will actually be an asset to the community.
Well, all right. Thanks so much for that, Reed. Well, that takes care of my prepared questions. Is there any other topic or issue you wanted to touch on before we wrap this up?
Thinking about the jail. I didn't have a prepared closing statement. I'll just say that I have enjoyed working at Beltrami County these last 4 years so much. It has been just such a wonderful education, and I really enjoyed doing it. I love representing the people of District 2, and I'm excited for the opportunity to do it again. So I guess I will just leave it with that.
All right. Thank you so much, Reed Olson, for Beltrami County District 2.